morning. It's the panel's understanding that Mr. Fukunaga will argue for 10 minutes, and then followed by Mr. Geller for 10 minutes, and then Mr. Fisher for 27 minutes, and then you'll have rebuttal for 10, and then you'll have rebuttal for 3 minutes. Is that correct? Okay, proceed, please.
Good morning, and thank you for allowing us to make an oral presentation to the court about this case. I would like to introduce my co-counsel, Mr. Geller, who will be addressing the punitive damages issue. He's from the Mayer Brown firm in Washington, D.C. The TK-821 buckle, about which this case is about, is one of the safest buckles ever manufactured. As we know from the record in this case, they were installed in millions of vehicles around the world. Likely, they were driven billions of miles, and likely they were involved in thousands of accidents. And yet, in those 4 countries in which they were installed, the U.S., Japan, Australia, and the European Union, there were no reports of the 3 defect theories the plaintiffs have advanced in this case: false latch, inertial release, and inadvertent actuation.
Counsel, can we take judicial notice of the fact that these buckles were recalled in 1995?
These buckles were not recalled.
Were they a different type of buckles?
The TK-52 was recalled. The TK-821.
Okay. But the recall also applied to the 1987 Nissan, didn't it?
No, the recall had to do with the TK-52 buckle. That was a buckle installed from about 1992 in vehicles, not just the Nissan Pathfinder, but also the Isuzu Rodeo, as well as a number of Toyota vehicles. As I was saying, the TK-821 buckle, which is a buckle at issue in this case, was designed by Takata pursuant to specifications from Nissan. But there are no proven incidents. There are no proven incidents at all in the record in this case that any other complaints were ever made about the buckle which resulted in a finding of a defect.
Counsel, isn't sort of the foundational issue in this case is whether or not Mr. Udock was wearing the seatbelt at the time of the accident?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the crux of this case.
And didn't the jury conclude he was wearing the seatbelt, basically a credibility issue, believing Dr. Renfro, Paul Udock, as opposed to the defendant's experts?
It's a credibility issue at the beginning, but if you look in the record of this case, and as I think the court is aware, there was certain evidence that was precluded from the jury, including a surrogate study by Dr. Banks, our biomechanic expert.
But before we get to Dr. Banks, whether or not that should have been excluded, assuming for a moment Dr. Banks' testimony as to the loading marks or the bruises was properly excluded, aren't you somewhat stuck on the issue of whether or not he was wearing the seatbelt?
Well, the jury did make a finding that impliedly that he was wearing a seatbelt. But as far as the evidence they used to make that decision, our argument before this court, that evidence was tainted. Because, for example, the patents that were introduced at trial could have been used by the jury to make that decision. That is, they did not rely just on the testimony from Mr. Udock, from Paul Udock, from Ikai Kavernis. The jury could just as well have said, well, the patents tell us this buckle is effective. So really, we're not relying upon the testimony of these witnesses, because, you know, it's about 3 years post-accident by the time they testified. Both of the boys had fallen asleep. There were issues about Mr. Vernis having had 4 40-ounce beers. So there were a lot of issues about whether to believe or not believe the witnesses. The jury could just as well have focused on the Nissan design specification, the 1995 spec. They could have just as well focused on the patents. They could have focused also on the failure to warn theory, which we believe was incorrectly presented to the jury. They could have focused on the false latch theory. Those are all possibilities if you're talking about what the jury used in arriving at their decision. So it's not simply the matter that the jury used testimony from the witnesses and made a decision.
One of the arguments made in the briefs was that the meaning, the language of the patent should have been construed by the judge, not the jury. Is that your position?
I think that's one of the amicus positions.
Not yours.
Our position is that the patent should never have gotten to the jury.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
How does Hawaii Rules of Evidence Rule 407 come into play in this case?
Well, Your Honor, 407 I don't believe comes into play in this case.
Because there, you don't believe the changes that were made to the buckle were remedial measures or improvements to the product that...
407, yeah, 407, as the court is aware, provides that evidence of subsequent remedial measures may be introduced to prove defect. The subsequent remedial measure, giving the benefit of the doubt to the plaintiffs at this point, but the TK52 patent, which you have before you, that we asked the court if we could show you, the TK52 patent you have before you, if that is a subsequent remedial measure, that is a different buckle than the TK-821. The 821 is a different buckle than the 52. The only testimony in this case, the only testimony at all, the only evidence in this case is from Mr. Kitamura, who said the two buckles are different. He testified that the 821 and the 52 are different. Therefore, 407 doesn't come into play at all because the TK-821 buckle was not redesigned and became the 52. The 52 is a different buckle. So 407 is totally irrelevant to the issue of whether there's a subsequent remedial measure. There is no subsequent remedial measure. You would have to show that the 821 was changed to the 52, and there is absolutely no evidence in the record on that issue.
Just a little bit, whether you revise a prior buckle or you build from scratch something to correct a defect in another buckle, is it the same thing, essentially, in terms of remedial measures?
Well, the history of Rule 407 was introduced to show in a particular product, a specific product at issue in a case, and this is based on notes from Mr. Bowman, the evidence reporter. But the history of 407 indicates it had to do with a specific product that was at issue, whether that product then was changed in some fashion. We know from, as I said, the testimony in the case that the 52 buckle and the 821 and the A95 buckle are all different. There is simply no evidence in the record to show that these are similar or that the 821 was changed subsequently.
But Rule 407 provides that, well, assuming it has any applicability, that remedial measures are inadmissible to prove negligence or culpable conduct, but it is admissible to prove dangerous defect. So when you allege both negligence, or when the plaintiffs allege both negligence and strict liability, how do you keep evidence that's admissible for one count out of the jury's ears for the other count?
Well, Your Honor, you know, we have never been in favor of Rule 407 because it has a number of problems with it. Not all jurisdictions have a Rule 407. Many jurisdictions do not allow subsequent remedial measures into evidence for various reasons, one of which you just revealed to us, which is when a case such as the UDAC case has an allegation of negligence against Takata, it has an allegation of product defect, and yet you have Rule 407 basically excluding proof of subsequent remedial measures on negligence, but admitting it to show product defect. You need a very carefully crafted jury instruction. And, of course, there was no instruction to that effect in this case. So if the court is suggesting that 407 came into play in this case, I would also suggest to the court that that is another reason for reversing the trial court's decision, because there was simply no instruction given on subsequent remedial measure. 407 was not even argued, if my memory serves me correct, at argument. There was a generic argument that the patent, the TK52 patent you have before you, referred to the 821 buckle. But again, that was based on no evidence before the court. Would you like me to pick up where I left off, or I have 1 minute left according to my watch? Since we've been talking about the patent issue quite a bit here this morning, at least my 9 minutes worth, I think it's useful for you to take a look at the patent in the few minutes, seconds I have left. And if you can look at the highlighted portion that we've tabbed for you. And I'm going to have to go a little bit over to do this, but what I would suggest to the panel is that by reading the highlighted portion together, you will come away convinced that this patent does not talk about a safety issue. It talks about a trade-off between a very strong spring that holds a latch plate in place, therefore resistant to inertial release, the same spring you have to press down on in order to release the buckle. And actually, plaintiffs brought a buckle with them today so we can take a look at it. But because the same spring subserves both functions, the stronger you make that spring to hold the latch plate in place in the buckle, the harder it is for the user to press down on the release button and release it. So this patent is talking about how to make it more user-friendly, that is the release button, so users do not have to struggle to release their button. Because under FMVSS 209, which is one of the federal regulations in issue in this case, a buckle also has to release with a certain amount of pressure. Because if you are caught in a car with a fire, obviously the last thing you want is a buckle that's hard to release. Or if your car goes into a lake, you'd like to get out.
And it's your position that the lower court judge admitted this because he just read it wrong, didn't understand it.
I don't know if you read it. Our position is that...
You didn't read it?
I don't know if you read it. Our position is that it should not have been admitted into evidence. Period. And I think I've used up my 10 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. It's a pleasure to be here. As Mr. Fukunaga mentioned, I'd like to spend a few minutes focusing on the enormous punitive damages verdict in this case. The jury awarded $12.5 million punitive damages, which equals the largest such award in the history of the state of Hawaii. Whatever conclusion that the court might reach as to compensatory damages, this is an entirely inappropriate case, we believe, for punitive damages. Now, as the court is aware, the Hawaii Supreme Court has sharply limited the circumstances in which punitive damages may be awarded in this state. Punitive damages are not available unless the plaintiff can show that the defendant acted with such malice as to amount to willful or outrageous misconduct. And as the Supreme Court put it in the Masaki case, to justify an award of punitive damages, a positive element of conscious wrongdoing is always required. And in addition, the plaintiff has to establish that conscious wrongdoing by clear and convincing evidence. In other words, Your Honors, to be eligible for punitive damages in this case, Mr. Udak had to prove by clear and convincing evidence that Takata knew that the TKA-21 buckle was defective when it sold the equipment to Nissan to be placed in plaintiff's automobile. Your Honors, we submit that not only was there no clear and convincing evidence of conscious wrongdoing in this case, there was in fact no evidence presented of any wrongdoing whatsoever, and that award of punitive damages, much less the largest award of punitive damages in the history of the state, is a travesty of justice. Now, as Mr. Fukunaga mentioned, the evidence was undisputed at trial that the TKA-21 buckle not only satisfied all of the federal government's safety standards, not only was found to be safe by an independent testing laboratory, but it had been installed in millions and millions of vehicles around the world for more than 20 years without a single proven instance that it failed to act properly. This is the first case, Your Honors, the first case in which any court has ever found that the TK-821 buckle was in any way defective. And as we've pointed out in our brief, there's substantial reason to doubt whether it was really defective in this instance as well. Now, Your Honors, how can it possibly be shown by clear and convincing evidence that Takata was guilty of conscious wrongdoing when it had every reason to believe that the seatbelt was not only safe but extraordinarily safe, since over a period of 2 decades, it had never before even once failed?
Counsel, what sort of deference do we give to the jury on this finding? Because obviously they found to the contrary.
Well, I think you'd have to look at the evidence and take a look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, and we would conclude that even if you do that, there's absolutely no evidence here, as we explained in our brief, and I hope to explain in a minute, that would support any punitive damages award. It was undisputed, as I say, at trial, that this Buckle had never, ever before failed. Now, the plaintiffs relied on a couple of pieces of evidence, most specifically and most importantly, these patent applications. I think it was a gross miscarriage of justice to admit those patent applications, as I hope to discuss in a minute, but there's really no evidence here. There was no credibility findings or any of that. It was simply putting a few documents before the jury. The court can look at those documents themselves. It's inconceivable if you do that, I think, that you would find that there was clear and convincing evidence of conscious wrongdoing here.
Plaintiffs suggest that they asked for information, not of court cases, but also of settlements that you folks may have effectuated with others, and that was never provided.
I'm not aware that anything was withheld as to any defect that ever involved the TK-821. Mr. Kitamura testified that there was only one complaint ever filed against the TK-821. It was this Emmert complaint. The plaintiffs never put in any evidence as to how that case was resolved, so it was simply an allegation. But there was absolutely no proof whatsoever withheld or offered at trial that there were allegations made against the TK-821 that were settled. There was simply this one allegation in the Emmert complaint. And the plaintiffs had the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence and never even showed what the outcome was of that case.
Didn't the jury also rely on Dr. Renfro's testimony? He was pretty damning, wasn't he, on the buckle, the seatbelt?
Well, he said that this was the most effective buckle he'd ever seen in his life. But
apparently they believed in credibility.
Well, as I say, there are many issues involved in this case as to compensatory damages, but there's a whole different ballgame as to punitive damages.
Talk to us about the ratio. I mean, we don't have a case on point. We all know with the Exxon case. We've all read that.
Well, the ratio goes to excessiveness. Okay. I'm happy to discuss that, but our principal argument here, Your Honors, and I don't want to leave without making it, is that this is an inappropriate case for punitive damages at all, much less the largest award in the history of the state of Hawaii. The ratio here is in single digits, but the many courts have held that when the compensatory damages are very high, even an award of a 1-to-1 ratio is excessive. We certainly think that's the case in this case. It's a very large compensatory award which serves any deterrence purpose of punitive damages. And if the court upholds the punitive damages award, we would clearly argue, as we have in our brief, that the amount of the award has to be substantially reduced. But our principal argument is that there's a very high standard for punitive damages in this state. It's not only a high substantive standard, but you have to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. And take a look at this record. There was at the time that Takata sold the seatbelt in 1987, these seatbelts had been on the road for billions of miles. There had never, ever been an allegation that something had gone wrong with these seatbelts. How can this be a case of conscious wrongdoing? Now, and I would ask the court to compare this case with every other automobile defect punitive damages case that the plaintiffs have called to your attention. In every one of those cases, every single one of those cases, there was strong evidence that the manufacturer knew of the defect, either from numerous prior injury reports or from its own testing. There was none of that here. Now, Mr. Yudak at trial relied principally on these patent applications that referred to earlier, and I really want to talk in my remaining time about those patent applications because they were so critical. It was the very first item that the trial judge mentioned in upholding the punitive damages award. The plaintiff's counsel repeatedly harped on these patent applications in his opening argument and his closing argument to prove that Takata knew of this defect. Now, I hope Your Honors can take the time to read these patent applications. If you read them, they're in the record. I think you'll see that the plaintiff completely misrepresented to the jury what these patents said. And the prejudicial impact of these misrepresentations on the jury was devastating, as you can imagine, since the plaintiff repeatedly and falsely told the jury, without any support whatsoever, that Takata had admitted that the TK-821 was a defective buckle. In fact, the patents didn't say anything of the kind. They didn't suggest it. They didn't intimate it. They didn't hint at it. They said nothing to suggest that the TK-821 was subject to any sort of defect.
Do you think it really was the patents that prejudiced the jury or the specs and the subsequent specs?
Well, there were two principal pieces of evidence that the plaintiff relied on. One was the patent applications, which I think was the heart of the case and the very first thing mentioned by the judge in upholding the punitive damages award. I might say in findings of fact that were drafted by the plaintiff. But there are also those 1992 specifications, which were completely inapplicable. If I had the time, I would discuss them as well. They're discussed in our brief. But the 1992 NDS were completely inapplicable to the 1987 Pathfinder. So those shouldn't
have been...
That's
what the specs referred to those, that ball, mm-hmm. I guess, and having the jury see that a golf ball can open...
But the fact, Your Honor, that a 40-millimeter ball can open a buckle tells you nothing at all about whether that buckle is defective. Buckles that are opened by 40-millimeter balls are used in cars all the time. It all depends on what the internal configuration is of the car. That's why Nissan was perfectly happy to have a 40-millimeter ball open the buckle in the 1987 Pathfinder, but not in the 1992 Pathfinder, presumably because they changed the internal structure of the car. So to take the 1992 NDS and apply it retroactively in 1987, when Nissan never ever intended it to be applied to 1987 cars, was again a gross miscarriage of justice.
How were the cars different?
Well, they must have been. It was plaintiff's burden of proving that they were the same. If he was going to try to use the 1992 NDS. To show that the 1987 Pathfinder was in some way defective, because the NDS that applied to the 1987 Pathfinder, which was the 1981 NDS, did not impose any 40-millimeter ball test. So, Your Honors, I know my red light is up and I'm going to sit down, but I can't implore you enough to read these patent applications, because if you do, they're in the record. They say what they say. It's not a credibility question. I'm 100% convinced you'll conclude that they simply said that the TK52 and the A95 buckles were simply addressing an issue of consumer convenience, as Mr. Fukunaga said. There's not a word in there about a safety problem. And yet the plaintiff repeatedly told the jury that this was evidence of a safety defect and was the principal reason to award punitive damages against a buckle that had never, ever failed. And I think that's a gross
miscarriage. Counsel, this doesn't go to your rebuttal time. We won't penalize you, but it wasn't just the jury. The judge agreed with the jury, right, on the patents?
Yes, he did, as I say, in findings of fact that were drafted by the plaintiff. But I don't think Your Honors owe any deference to any of those findings, because there's no credibility question here of findings of fact. It's just looking at the patent applications, which are in the record. This court is as able to read those patent applications as anyone else. And as I say, if you read those patent applications and you agree with us, as I'm sure you will, that they say nothing at all to suggest that Takata knew there was a safety problem, then I don't see how this punitive damages award can be upheld.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
May it please the court. My name is Jeff Fisher. I'm here today representing the plaintiffs in this case, the appellees. With me today are co-counsel Stephen Hisaka, Gail Cosgrove, Dwayne Lerma, and Joanne Goya, also representing the plaintiffs. And I'd like to advise the court that the plaintiffs themselves are in the courtroom today. If it pleases the court, I will start with focusing on the two primary issues that our opponents have talked about today. First, the supposed lack of accidents with respect to this buckle, and second, the patents. And then in my time remaining, I'd be happy to turn to the punitive award itself and, of course, answer any questions the court has. There are two problems with Takata's emphasis in the court today about the supposed lack of accidents on the TK-821. First, under Hawaii law in the Lau case, which is cited in our brief, in order for a defendant to rely on the lack of prior claims of accidents or such, they have to introduce evidence showing that there's a system for collecting and maintaining records of such reports. Takata didn't do that in this case. Instead, the only evidence that it relies on are the statements of the engineer, Mr. Kitamura, for this supposed claim. But even if we could get around that, we'd have the problem with the discovery dispute that the parties had, and the court mentioned this earlier, and I just want to be sure the court understands the record in this respect. We repeatedly asked Takata for evidence of any prior claims with respect to the TK-821, whether they went to a full lawsuit or not. Takata objected to that on the grounds of privacy. They said to turn over that information would infringe the privacy rights of the people who had made such claims.
Did you make a motion to compel?
We kept arguing with Takata, Your Honor, and then on the eve, so for 2 years, Takata left that objection in place. We did not make a motion to compel because we might have thought that if they're not going to respond to such a request, they're not going to make the argument they ultimately made. But they left that objection in place for 2 years. Discovery cutoff was September 24th of 2005. On September 23rd, Takata submitted an after-hours supplemental response to our discovery request, at which time, the night before the discovery deadline, they withdrew their objection.
Wasn't it your duty to file a motion to compel if you're going to seek sanctions to keep evidence out later or to object to an argument? I mean, isn't that the burden of the one seeking the information to move the ball forward and to get a court order?
Well, we would have filed a motion to compel if we would have wished to argue that there had been accidents that had been reported to Takata. Having had no response to that, we were content to leave that evidence where it was and to leave Mr. Kitamura's unsubstantiated claims in his deposition for Takata to argue to the jury. And, of course, Takata did make its arguments to the jury. And this brings us to the legal question that overlays this, which is Takata hasn't cited any cases at which even a defendant showing lack of accidents absolves it of liability. If the plaintiffs show, as we did in this case, and as the jury believed our lay witnesses and expert witnesses, that there was a defective product, and then as we turned to punitive damages, that Takata was aware that it was a defective product, then we were fully entitled to win the case. And these were credibility issues that the jury was entitled to resolve.
Counsel, you didn't mention in your opening, but one issue really concerns me is Dr. Banks, his testimony being excluded on the grounds that he wasn't qualified to discuss the results of a surrogate study, to basically point out where the loading mark would have been based on his study, that he wasn't qualified. Tell me how Dr. Banks wasn't qualified to talk about his own study that he conducted and testified to.
With respect to Your Honor, Dr. Banks was not excluded from testifying due to lack of qualifications. The ruling of the trial court was that Dr. Banks could not testify about a surrogate study because he was qualified, and sorry, I'm using the same word, but he had been introduced by Takata as a accident reconstructionist, not as a seatbelt expert. Their seatbelt expert was Dr. Cooper. And the trial court order in place in this case demanded of both parties, and this is quoted at Takata's reply brief in footnote 7, the pretrial order that applied to both parties said that expert testimony was fixed as of their depositions. Now, in Dr. Banks's deposition, he testified at page 77, quote, "I did not rely upon this data," which is to say the surrogate study, "in formulating any of my opinions in this case." So we don't know why he did it, but when he was asked about it in his deposition, he said, "I didn't rely on this." And he said at page 56 of his deposition, "This was not my area. The seatbelt was not my area. This was Mr. Cooper's area." So that's why it was excluded. And if you look at the Pines Properties case, which we've cited in our brief, we think it's the closest case that either party has found on point, and it holds that by definition, a trial court acts within its discretion if it excludes testimony that is outside of the area that the expert was set to testify.
And bruises were also outside of his expertise?
Bruises were closer within his expertise because he did have a report and he did testify that the bruises on Dason Udak's body were as a result of being thrown from the Pathfinder, and that supported Dr. Banks's view that he was not wearing his seatbelt. But I really think the issue with respect to the bruises on Dace's body is very easily resolved by a glance at the record, because this is at pages 117 through 119, where this is discussed in the record. And after going back and forth about that, whether this was truly within the scope of Dr. Banks's report, the next question that's asked by Mr. Fukunaga is whether he noticed by looking at the photographs in the medical record, whether he noticed any bruises on Dason Udax's waist that would have been the result of a seatbelt, and he says no. So he, in fact, gave the testimony that Takata is complaining he wasn't able to give. And the only other mark that Paul Udak, when he had testified, had suggested he thought may have been caused by the seatbelt was a mark on his shoulder. And there's earlier testimony where Dr. Banks addresses that and says he doesn't believe that's from the seatbelt. Dakota itself, in its brief, acknowledges that he was allowed to testify on that. But if you look at the testimony on page 119, it's clear that Dr. Banks gave the testimony that that he would have given. And of course, even taking this within the broader realm of the full scope of evidence in this case, there were not just Dason Udak and the person in the car with him that night, but there were others who testified about Dason's seatbelt usage. Dr. Renfro also testified that he looked at the seatbelt and saw what he described as loading marks, which would have been caused by the accident from having him wear the seatbelt. So there was plenty of evidence in the record from the jury for the jury to conclude that Dason was
wearing. Were there any photos in the record of bruises right after the accident? I know there are bruises 5 weeks later, but is there anything?
I believe, Your Honor, that there are photographs, medical photographs taken when he was in the hospital after the accident.
Do you know where they are?
I'm not certain on that, but I can find that out and submit it to the court. If I might turn to the patents, Your Honor, because the first thing I want to say is it's Takata's characterization that the patents were the principal piece of evidence in the case that we relied on. That's not our position, and if you look at the trial transcript, you'll see that it's one of many pieces of evidence. The patents, and I will list them all when we talk about the punitive award, the other evidence that supports our ability to get punitive damages. But let me just say a couple words about the patents, because Takata's challenge to the patents is a relevance challenge. They argue under Rule 401 that the trial court should have excluded them as irrelevant. Now, that's a high bar for Takata to get over, because, as you know, evidence is relevant if it has any tendency at all to make a fact more or less probable. And so in that respect, I'd like the court to look at the patent as Takata's given it to you. They have, two sets of language that it highlighted. And right before the first highlighted passage is the passage that the plaintiffs relied on. And it says, when the force required to release the buckle is reduced by decreasing the spring force, so also is the retaining force between the tongue and the latching decreased. Thus, when an impact force, as caused by a vehicle collision, is supplied to the seatbelt, the latch plate displaces by inertial release. So what this patent says is, with a patent that uses a spring to keep the latch in place, which I think it's undisputed that the TKA21 was one of those kind of buckles, when the spring is not strong enough, it is susceptible to inertial release. Now, we think that on its own is sufficient to get over the low relevance bar. Takata was free, as it did, to make all the arguments it wanted about the true safety of the TKA21 and why they had the TK52 patent, but just the very existence of language that says that these kind of buckles, if the spring isn't strong enough, can be susceptible to inertial release is relevant evidence toward us proving a defect. But if that isn't enough, this court can look at the patent for the TK821 itself. And this is at page 318 of the TK821 patent, which is Plaintiff Exhibit 1585. And on that page, in describing the amount of force necessary to release the buckle, and remember, what Takata's here saying today, and what they argued to the jury, is that we had to make it hard, the spring buckles have to be hard to release, and that causes user inconvenience. Well, if you look at page 318 of the 821 buckle, it says that it can be released with a, quote, small pressing force. And in other parts of the patent, it describes the small manipulative force necessary to release that buckle. So if there's any doubt when you put those together, there is more than ample reason for the judge to have let these patents into evidence and to let the parties argue about them. And I might add, with respect to Takata's argument about whether they're confusing, the Udaks actually asked to have the author of the patents put on the stand so that the parties could ask questions about what they really meant. Takata objected to that and kept that person out of the court. Takata was also free to put its own expert or anyone else they would have wanted to put on the stand to talk about what they really meant or if there were any technical arguments they feared might confuse the jury, and they didn't do so. So what you really have is a jury question with evidence that was relevant.
The meaning of a patent is a jury question, not a question for a judge. What a patent means is not a legal issue.
Well, the Supreme Court has held that claims in a patent the invention that a patent claims, at least in a patent infringement case, is a question of law. But even in patent infringement cases, the specifications of a patent, which is to say the descriptions of prior art, which are merely factual statements, they're not claiming any invention, they're just factual background statements, are questions of fact for a jury. And indeed, that's in patent infringement cases. No court has ever held that specifications are questions of law for a judge in a patent infringement case, or certainly not in any tort case. And if there were any question on that, I would say, I think as Takata somewhat acknowledged today, that this was not an argument they fairly presented to the trial court. This is something that amicus has made on its behalf, but that's not enough under the Hawaii rules to preserve an objection.
So the trial court judge's comments on what the patent may have meant, and we should just disregard that, because it was solely within the province of the jury.
Well, with respect to whether a defect was shown, yes, but with respect to the findings of fact that support the punitive award, maybe this is a good time for me to transition to the punitive award, I think that Mr. Geller properly stated the standard that you review the factual evidence in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs. And then there's ultimately a legal question as to the size of the award. Now, the patent specifications, the prior art, are one piece of that prior, one piece of the evidence we relied on. And let me say,
I'm punitives. If we admit the patents or subsequent changes made to a product to make it better or to make it safer for the consumer, aren't you basically you're going to deter manufacturers from making changes if those changes are going to be used as admissions against them? And so from a public policy standpoint, is that something that this court should embrace?
With all respect, I don't think you're free to, Your Honor. That is a legitimate public policy debate, and as Takata mentioned, there are some states that have stricter rules of evidence with respect to the gateway requirement for subsequent remedial measures, but Hawaii's law on its face allows subsequent remedial measures in product defect cases like this one, which I imagine that is why, one reason why, Takata didn't rely and it has never made a Rule 407 objection. There's another problem with that, too, in that subsequent remedial measures typically kick in after the accident issue in a case. And, of course, the patents that we're talking about in this case improved on the 821, but they were far before the accident in this case. No one's contending that those patents were in response to the today's new
tax. Just because you filed for an application for a patent doesn't mean that that product is in production, does it?
Not necessarily. I don't think so, Your Honor. In production, you said?
Yeah. It's an idea that you're patenting and you plan to go forward with it, but just it was about the same time, right? So doesn't mean that because they're aware of the defect that the idea that they patented was available for them to use.
There are two patents, Your Honor. The first one is from 1984, which is 3 years before they supplied the seat buckle in this case to Nissan. And the second one is about the same time, so we don't know how that timeline works out. But of course, both of those patents are several years before the accident occurred in this case, in which Takata would have had ample time to provide any warning. And so what I'd like to do is just mention a few other pieces of evidence that support our punitive damage award, because it's not just the patents, as Takata says. And perhaps the most damning piece of evidence is one that hasn't been mentioned yet today, which is Mr. Kitamura's own testimony that he tested the buckle under the 40-millimeter ball test before it was ever submitted to Nissan. And this is in the 80s. And he found that it would open with a golf ball size sphere. And it doesn't take a lot of technical understanding to appreciate why that would pose a safety risk, especially in a vehicle like the 1987 Nissan Pathfinder, in which the buckle receptacle was raised up in the vehicle. If a ball can open a little the buckle just by pressing on it, so can an elbow. And that's what Dr. Renfro testified to on behalf of the plaintiffs. And he explained that that while Nissan waited until 1992 to put that into its specifications, several other car manufacturers, Mercedes, GM, Ford, use a 40-millimeter ball test or an even smaller ball test to test the safety of their vehicles. And so there's ample evidence in the record that this is a well-accepted safety test, and that before the buckle was ever given to Nissan, Takata's chief engineer was aware that it didn't pass it. That combined with the 92 specifications, the patents, and other evidence in the record, we think collectively clearly provided enough evidence of knowledge well before the accident to have given this question to the jury.
If Dr. Banks' testimony had come in on the loading mark, that could have impacted the jury, could it not have? Whether punitive damages should have been awarded or damages at all?
I don't think Dr. Banks' testimony was particularly relevant to punitive damages. Dr. Banks' testimony was primarily aimed at whether or not Dayson was wearing his seatbelt or not.
Right. I mean, if you don't get past that, you don't.
Well, of course, I agree. If we don't get past liability in the first place, we, of course, don't get to punitive damages.
That's right.
But
how could that be harmless? I mean, it was argued in the answering brief that even if Dr. Banks' testimony should have come in, excluding it was harmless. How could that be harmless?
Well, it could be harmless for a couple reasons, Your Honor. First of all, because Mr. Cooper himself testified as to loading marks on the seatbelt. And at page 42 and 43 of his trial testimony, he is asked by Takata's counsel, where on the seatbelt would you expect to find loading marks? And he...
Mr. Cooper was not a doctor or an expert in biomechanics or had conducted a surrogate study, had he?
No, he hadn't, but he was their seatbelt expert, and he gave the testimony and said, I don't see any marks here. But on the surrogate study itself, I think there's good reason why Dr. Banks would have said in his deposition, I didn't rely on this. And if you look at the deposition pages, and around page 70 to 77 and thereabouts in his deposition, he explains that the surrogate study, and if you look at it, it's in the record, it's a two-page memorandum of just typed up notes. It's not a sophisticated piece of work. He admits, I used two different cars, I used different seats, I didn't know exactly how Dayson would have been reclining his seat in this car because the best I could do is use a picture and guess where he would have had the seat in the car. And so there's a lot about the surrogate study itself that even had it come in would have been susceptible to a great deal of attack. And finally, remember that Takata's counsel said, even when they were trying to get in the surrogate study, that this pertains to just the lack of one single mark. Dr. Renfro testified that he saw several marks, not just the D-ring plate mark, but other marks in other places in the seatbelt caused by loading. So at the very most, Takata, even granting every possible inference in their favor, granting every possible inference that the surrogate study would have been believed by the jury as dependable, it would have knocked out one loading mark of several that Dr. Renfro identified.
And what's our standard of review of the punitive damages award?
Your standard of review is looking at the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, and you have a set of findings from the trial court in that respect, to which are historical findings that you defer to on the clearly erroneous standard. Taking all that into account, then you have a legal question, which is a de novo question, whether the size of the punitive award in this case is excessive. And so you asked about ratio earlier. Perhaps that's a good thing for me to talk about right now. If you look at Supreme Court precedent, here's what you have. You have U.S. Supreme Court precedent. You have three cases that have overturned punitive damage awards with ratios of 500 to 1, 145 to 1, and 90 to 1. You have two other cases that have upheld punitive damage verdicts, the Haslip case and the TXO case, with ratios of 4 to 1 and 10 to 1. So the crux of Takata's argument when they ask for something for this punitive award, which is a 2-to-1 ratio to be overturned, is one sentence of dicta in the State Farm case where the Supreme Court said that in certain cases, perhaps, the court said, punitives might not be able to exceed a 1-to-1 ratio. But if you look at the scope of lower court precedent, both before and after State Farm, and indeed if you look at State Farm itself, which on remand the Utah Supreme Court reduced to a 9-to-1 ratio and the U.S. Supreme Court denied further review of that case. The lower courts have almost uniformly understood the Supreme Court's guidance, both before and after State Farm, as generally allowing single-digit multipliers. Takata has cited to this court, a couple of cases from the Eighth Circuit, which are highly factual, and a couple of cases in their 28J letter from the Southern District of New York that operated under a fairly unusual New York law. Apart from that, the enormously wide swath of precedent in this country, and we've cited it in our briefs, and in particular, several cases involving automobile accidents because of product defects have uniformly allowed single-digit multipliers. And so let me say one thing about the Exxon Valdez case, because it's the court's most recent statement on punitive damages. The Exxon Valdez case, as Takata recognized in its 28J letter, rests on maritime law. It's not a constitutional case. And in fact, if you want to read tea leaves from the Exxon case, I think the best thing you can do is understand that there were three dissenting justices in the Exxon case that would have allowed the 5-to-1 ratio there under maritime law, and two other justices who wrote separately to say that on a constitutional basis they would have upheld the award. So there's five justices in Exxon saying that 5-to-1 is okay as a constitutional matter. The court also contemporaneously denied certiorari of a case, Action Marine, which both parties had cited, and it's now in the 28J letter, involving a 5-to-1 ratio, about a $17 million punitive award. So the court, I think, is sending fairly consistent signals that we're concerned with triple-digit ratios, we're concerned with out-of-whack punitive awards, but awards that bear the traditional kind of double-treble damage relationship to the underlying harm are ones that we're going to leave in place. And Takata had, it comes here today and says this is the biggest verdict in the history of Hawaii. We believe there's a couple other cases. The Masaki case, of course, involved a verdict of over $11 million. The Supreme Court of Hawaii vacated that verdict, but didn't question the size of the award. And the Kalamata case was a product liability case in Hawaii that involved a $14 million punitive award. And so Takata had fair notice that the size of the award in Hawaii and, of course, across the country was something that could happen. And because of the relationship to the harm, which is in the traditional range of treble damages, they had ample notice that in a catastrophic accident like this, based on the kind of knowledge that they had going into it, that they could be hit with a verdict like this. And so we think that based on all that, this court has ample reason to affirm the decision below. I'd be happy to answer any other questions the court has before
I sit down. One follow-up question. I hope I'm not being redundant, but going back to the patents, there's no question we have to defer to the jury as far as credibility of the experts, that they believe Dr. Renfro instead of Mr. Cooper. Dr. Banks, but we have to give no deference to them. We can read the patents. I mean, there's no credibility issues. We didn't have to be in the courtroom. It's just the language of all the patents, whether it's the TK-821 or the 57, is it? Or, you know, I mean, 52.
Yeah.
I mean, we can read it just as well as the jurors, right?
I think that's right, but it's important to understand what question you're asking, because remember, you're asking whether you should give deference to the jury's finding that there was a defect. And so with respect to the evidence that depends on credibility, you do give deference. With respect to this piece of evidence, in assessing it and asking yourself the question whether there was sufficient evidence for the jury to have found a defect and then ultimately for the jury to have found punitive damages, you can look at this single piece of evidence more straight up. But there's no, I just want to emphasize, there's no singular question that turns on the patent. The patent is one piece of evidence that gets taken into consideration with the other evidence in the case that was submitted in terms of asking yourself whether the jury had a proper basis to make the findings it did.
Certainly a significant piece of evidence, isn't it?
Oh, we don't deny that it's a significant piece of evidence. We just don't want the court to think that our whole case, as Takata seems to be wanting you to think today, turned on the patents.
Dr. Renfro did a good job, too.
Thank you. If there are no other questions, I'll...
Thank you.
Just a time check. I think I have 10 minutes left at this point. There are some rebuttal comments I'd like to make about what Mr. Fisher argued to you, and then I'll defer to Mr. Geller to cover some of the punitive damage issues that Mr. Fisher also covered. So we'll be splitting the remaining time between the two of us. Mr. Fisher argued to you that Takata had no procedure in place for gathering information about accidents in the real world, and therefore there was a question about how Takata receives information about accidents in the real world. Mr. Kitamura at his deposition testified that the quality control department, of which he was the head, receives information from Nissan and also from outsiders. Remember, the TK-821 buckle was sold around the world, Japan, Australia, and Europe. In Europe, there's a different reporting system through the European Union. So the reporting systems do not follow just the U.S. model of complaints being filed. In the European Union, the government actually takes control of many of the issues which consumers would otherwise complain about in the U.S. So it's not the case that Takata had no procedure in place. There was testimony presented to the jury about the procedure Takata does follow to find out what is happening in the real world. And that is why the real world information and the evidence in this case is so very important. Because of the procedure in place and the fact that millions of these buckles, as the plaintiffs put in the order regarding the punitive damage award, the plaintiffs put millions of buckles were sold. So that is not an issue in the case. Millions were sold around the world. And the importance of that is that there are no other claims. The Emmert case, I'll also talk about just now, but the Emmert case, the one complaint that was filed against Takata, only alleges that the seatbelt restraint failed. It does not say the 821 buckle failed. We don't know whether it's the webbing, the anchor, the emergency locking retractor that failed in that case. So that case does not provide no notice at all to Takata about what happened as far as the accident in the Emmert case is concerned. The plaintiffs also, if they were very concerned about the lack of complaints and lack of claims except for the Emmert case, should have actually filed a motion to compel or somehow brought this issue up to the court. They failed to do that. Now they're complaining that there might have been other claims, other accidents that Takata did not reveal. At this point, I believe it's too late to argue about that issue. Again, Your Honors, the issue about the ball test came up, and if you just read, a lot of this case has to do with just reading documents, but if you just read the NDS, the 1992 NDS, it doesn't pertain to the 1987 Pathfinder. The 1987 Pathfinder's buckle was tested pursuant to the European Union standard, because remember, the 821 buckle is sold in the European Union. Because it's sold there, the union classifies buckles as enclosed or non-enclosed. Takata was performing the test for the 87 Pathfinder in terms of categorizing the buckle as being enclosed or not enclosed. It had nothing to do with whether it inadvertently released when a buckle or an elbow or some foreign object touches the buckle. The U.S. has never adopted that standard in their own federal motor vehicle safety standards. This time, just to save a few minutes, I'll defer to Mr. Geller on the punitive damage issues.
Hello again, Your Honors. I just want to spend a few minutes responding to a few points that Mr. Fisher made on punitive damages. Now, the plaintiffs here seem to be backing away quickly from the idea that the patent applications played a significant role in the award of punitive damages at trial, but I think that's inconsistent with the record in a number of respects. First, if you look at the trial court's findings of fact, which the plaintiffs themselves drafted and the trial judge just put out verbatim without changing a word, in defending the punitive damages award here,
can you speak up a little
bit? I'm sorry, Your Honor. In defending the punitive damages award here, the trial judge said that Takata's conduct was highly reprehensible. It produced a seatbelt buckle that suffers from several safety defects. And then what's the first item that the trial judge cites in support of that, drafted again by the plaintiffs, are these patent applications. Now, if you look at the patent applications, and I agree with Your Honor that you can read them just as well as the trial court did or the jury did, I'm afraid that Mr. Fisher, again, as they did in their brief, incompletely describes the patent applications, because he stops quoting at a certain point. Now, we've submitted the patent applications to you. You can read them for yourself. But he leaves out the critical paragraph, which talks about the fact that the spring has to be so strong that to prevent any sort of inertial release, that it sometimes leads to issues of consumer inconvenience. And then the critical paragraph, which is left out both in their brief and in Mr. Fisher's oral presentation to you today, is the paragraph that says, to alleviate this problem, mechanisms are added, and then it goes on to explain what the TK52 and the A95 do. To alleviate this problem, the problem they're talking about is consumer inconvenience, not safety. So if your honors read the patent applications as we do and reach that conclusion, then it seems to me there's no way that the punitive damages award can be upheld in this case. Now, when you asked Mr. Fisher, what else do you have other than the patent applications, the first thing he mentioned was Mr. Kittemwer's testimony as to the 40-millimeter ball test. I'm afraid, again, that Mr. Fisher has incompletely described to you that testimony, because if you looked at Mr. Kittemwer's testimony, if you look at page 213 from his deposition, and he's asked about the 40-millimeter ball test. He says, and I quote, I don't think the 40-millimeter ball test is used to judge inadvertent release. He didn't think that it had any relevance to inadvertent release. There's no proof that Takata thought it had any relevance to inadvertent release. Some buckles pass the 40-millimeter ball test and some don't. That doesn't mean they can't be put safely in automobiles. It just means which automobiles it has to be put safely in. And as I said when I was before you the last time, the NDS that applied to the 1987 Pathfinder did not say it had to pass a 40-millimeter ball test. So there's no proof whatsoever from Mr. Kittemwer's testimony, coming back again to the strict standard that the Misaki Court has imposed in Hawaii. There's absolutely no proof from that testimony, much less clear and convincing proof of any conscious wrongdoing. The final point I want to leave you with, Your Honors,
Do you know why the federal government has never adopted that 40-millimeter ball standard?
Yes, because it's not relevant in and of itself to whether or not a buckle is defective. It just describes the type of buckle that has to go into certain types of cars rather than other types of cars. But a buckle that doesn't pass the 40-millimeter ball test is not a defective buckle. It's not a buckle that's susceptible to inadvertent release, even though that's the argument by transposing the 1992 NDS retroactively to a car it didn't apply to. That's the argument they made at trial in an effort to obtain punitive damages here. But I want to just come back to the point that I started with an hour ago, Your Honors. It's difficult to get punitive damages in Hawaii. There have only been three judgments upheld on appeal that awarded even more than $1 million in punitive damages in the state of Hawaii. This is a $12.5 million award, the largest award ever awarded to any single plaintiff in the history of the state of Hawaii. Can this court honestly conclude this is the most reprehensible act? At the time that this seatbelt was produced, and even today, it's been on the road for 20 years, it's been buckled billions of times. This case is the first and only case in which any court or administrative agency has ever found that the buckle was defective. Now, we have arguments why compensatory damages shouldn't have been awarded here because of evidentiary rulings that were incorrect and instructions that were incorrect. Your Honors will have to deal with that. But however you come out on that, it seems to me inconceivable in a case like this with a record like this that this court could upheld a $12.5 million award of punitive damages and conclude that by clear and convincing evidence, the plaintiff showed that Takata was guilty of conscious wrongdoing in selling this completely, completely safe buckle.
Isn't that essentially what Dr. Renfro testified, though?
Dr. Renfro testified that this was the most defective buckle he'd ever seen in his life. Every defect a buckle can have, this buckle had. But where is the proof? Where is the proof? And that doesn't, of course, Dr. Renfro's testimony went to defect. It didn't go to state of mind. And state of mind is what's critical in Hawaii law on punitive damages. You had to prove, as I said earlier, that when they sold this buckle, they knew it was defective.
Couldn't the inference have been there it was so defective they had to know?
No, because a lot of the things that Mr. Renfrew talked about, there was no evidence that Takata was aware of them in 1987. As I said, there was no evidence that they had ever before been confronted with any sort of suggestion that this buckle had failed. They didn't believe this 40-millimeter ball test was relevant to inadvertent release. The Emmert complaint was just that, a complaint. There was no proof offered at trial that it ever went to judgment. So where is the evidence that supports the largest punitive award in the history of the state of Hawaii? Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honors, my understanding of the court order setting oral argument was that my rebuttal time was reserved for our cross-appeal, and as I'm sure you noticed, I didn't address our cross-appeal at the opening, and we are happy, as this court initially indicated, that it was happy to have this case submitted on the briefs. We're happy to submit the cross-appeal on the briefs. If the court would like, I could address a couple of the assertions Mr. Keller has made about whether I was fully giving the court the facts, but that's up to the court whether whether you'd like me to say a word or two about that. Okay. Sure, and we'll just rely on our briefs for a response to Mr. Geller's final argument. Thank you.
Thank you. We will take this matter under advisement.